The privatization of public services is a long-standing global trend. But in the wake of the pandemic and through the introduction of contact tracing apps, big tech has gone one step further. Large corporations like Amazon, Microsoft, and Google are now set to control the very infrastructure that underlies our public health system. In this eye-opening discussion, Arun Kundanani interviews Dr. Seda Gerses about the dangers of a system in which we depend on profit-oriented companies for receiving basic health services. How did we get to this point, and how can we imagine a different future? Dr. Seda Gerses is an associate professor at TU Delft and an affiliate at KU Leuven. Her work focuses on privacy-enhancing and protective optimization technologies, privacy engineering, as well as questions around software infrastructures, social justice, and political economy as they intersect with computer science. Arun Kundanani is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello. In this series of interviews, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an era of pandemics and climate breakdown. In this interview, I speak with Seda Gerses. Seda is a critical computer scientist at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. We discussed the ways that tech corporations such as Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Amazon have acquired new powers in public health as a result of the response to COVID and the issues of corporate power and accountability that this raises. It's an issue that's been largely ignored over the last 2 years, and Seda explains how these new developments do not fit earlier paradigms of privatization and algorithmic power. It's a really thought-provoking conversation and raises profound questions about the new world being invisibly created around us. Seda works with a group called Programmable Infrastructures, which looks at developing alternatives to corporate computing. You can find her on Twitter with the handle at S-E-D-Y-S-T. Remember, if you enjoyed the interview, please like and subscribe, and look out for more interviews over the coming weeks. Seda, thank you for joining us today. We're going to go straight in, and I just wanted to take us back to this moment in April 2020. So when we're sort of still just beginning to get our heads around COVID, and there's this moment when Apple and Google announce that they're going to work together to put Bluetooth contact tracing into their cell phone operating systems. And this is something that I know you've done some thinking about and responded to at the time. And it'd be good to start by just kind of, if you could just talk us through like what that moment represented, but what was the proposal there and what its significance was?
Sure. I think it might be nice to first, you know, rewind a moment and say that Google and Apple were summoned by governments who said we should have apps to amplify our capabilities in contact tracing. And the reason they summoned Google and Apple, even though they didn't call the names of these companies, is because there's no way to deploy an app in the world today without going through the operating systems of Android phones, which are basically controlled by Google, and Apple phones, which have iOS, which is controlled by Apple. And so in a sense, they said for our public health activities, in this case, contact tracing, we want to use the platforms of these two companies. Therefore, we are ready to sit at a table and negotiate with them. And in a sense, one could say, okay, but they could have just deployed an app. But indeed, this Bluetooth matter was relevant because basically, Bluetooth was never meant to measure distance, right? Bluetooth was there to transfer files. It was a replacement of cables, right? It was right. Basically a wireless technology. And what they wanted to do was use Bluetooth to measure distance. And in order to do that, they needed Bluetooth to work in the background and not, you know, consume too much battery power. And for this, they needed Apple. And on some level, although I don't think many people recognize this at that moment, they needed the two companies to make their Bluetooth signals, whatever it was going to be used for contact tracing, interoperable. So they needed their collaboration. And so in this sense, the moment that the government said we want apps, they said we want Google and Apple to be part of our public health initiatives. So that was, I think, the first one to remember. And Apple especially, I think, saw this as a great opportunity to build up on their growth mandate, which includes growing into other sectors, including health. They've been doing a lot of initiatives in the direction of health and public health, you know, which a lot of people will know about because of all the ways that iWatch or the step counters, right? Like those are all already sort of say symbolic of these initiatives. Now, what also happened at that moment for the government is that their imagination of how they would get in touch with their people was in a sense hijacked by the development of mobile devices as things that we carry around all the time that are in our pockets, right? For that a project that has been worked on, you know, since the 90s, all right? And so they kind of thought, oh my God, this is a great infrastructure. We can use it for public health. It's like having WhatsApp in everybody's pocket, right? Like we can have a public health in everybody's pocket. So in a sense, their imagination of how public health infrastructure works was hijacked by the possibility of being in everybody's pockets. So this is how Google and Apple entered the game. So they didn't enter it on their own device, but they were called in by governments who wanted these apps. So that's number one to remember. Number two, when the governments asked for apps, a lot of consultancy firms and a lot of startups kind of came in and said, we'll provide the app. And they wanted to collect all sorts of data that was absolutely unnecessary for contact tracing. So they were just proposing a lot of technologies that would basically build a massive surveillance infrastructure in the name of public health. And you and I know really well from 9/11, if these kind of surveillance infrastructures get set up in the moment of an emergency, they remain. And so my colleagues and I, and many other communities who work on privacy said, okay, let's do some damage control and let's see how we can lower the bar for entry for these people who are proposing apps and say, what is the minimum amount of data that we can collect to enable contact tracing without enabling a massive surveillance infrastructure? So until this moment, we knew that Google and Apple were going to come into the game, but we were functioning without them. And at some point they entered the game and they said, actually, we will take that privacy preserving protocol that you guys are working on. We won't just make it an app. In the case of Apple, they said, we'll push it into our operating system. And we will silently update all people's phones so that it's basically, you know, next to your sound settings or your telephone settings, you would also have a contact tracing setting, which was called the Google Apple Exposure Notification. And if governments want to build apps on top of that, we will control which public health entities come in. It has to be government sanctioned. So we'll only allow one, or if it's a regional public health or federation of public health institutions, we'll allow them to have apps. But they will have to use our interface from the operating system to these apps, right? And in doing so, they started not only deciding where public health would end and where their platform power would begin, but they also even, you know, started pushing the grounds on who could do scientific work, right? In the sense that at the time we were working with epidemiologists and you know, they would tell us, okay, what's the distance, what's the amount of time that would be considered a risk for somebody so that they would be defined as a contact, which is a definition given by the World Health Organization. So there's like massive levels of, let's say, calculation that has to be done. And had Google and Apple had said, we will define those risk scores, they would have also put all scientific work behind their infrastructure. But it just tells you that they had the power to all of a sudden, sanctioned by governments, enter everybody's pockets and enable a public health function, which would normally be a function that governments would provide. As a result, they were able to position themselves as arbiters between citizens and their governments. And this was also very clear in the way they said, we'll take this privacy preserving protocol. And if a government comes, like the French government did, and says, no, we want another protocol that would indeed, you know, collect more information in the hands of government entities or public health entities because we want to do research with this data, et cetera, they would say, no, you can't do that. And so by that, they were saying, well, your government is kind of intrusive. We will protect your privacy vis-a-vis this government, right? And so they really positioned themselves both as inevitable or, let's say, unescapable partners in public health for governments across the world that wanted to use apps and had the ability to use apps. And they positioned themselves as arbiters between citizens and governments with respect to privacy. So those were like huge steps, I think, very big steps.
So can you say a bit more about like how that kind of positioning then played out subsequently? And like, did that lead to them kind of grabbing new kinds of power or new resources in terms of the public health space subsequently?
So this is the interesting thing about big tech companies is that, you know, this is not just your typical privatization where you capture government tenders, right? Right, which also happens. But they practically did this for free. So then the question is, what is their gain? And I think the gain is, in a sense, twofold. They got recognition from governments that if you want to use our infrastructure, you have to go through us. And our infrastructure is very attractive to you. You can reach to whatever 60, 70, 80, 90% of your population, depending on the phone penetration. And governments thought this was a cool thing to do. A lot of politicians afterwards tried to look cool by saying they'd make an app for some random thing, which normalizes their infrastructure as a go-to for public services. And then on another level, they managed to ensure, you know, a seat at the table across countries for public health decisions, right? So now people would make sure that they ask Google and Apple what they thought or whether they would implement or et cetera, right? So the gain was not monetary. It was not a capture of resources per se, but it is a capture of infrastructure, right? In the sense that instead of having call centers, which would be funded by governments with people who are trained to do contact tracing, what we ended up having is a app, right? That did just some calculation, which had, you know, quite a bit of randomness because Bluetooth was not made for this. And at best, it led to, you know, call centers that you could get in touch with saying, I got notified that I've been the contact of somebody whose test is positive. What do I do now? So that part you could see is like as a more classical privatization, right? Like instead of having public health workers, you were all of a sudden forwarded to, in the case of the UK, for example, a bunch of teenagers who had that morning gotten a message in their room in lockdown using their own computers, now becoming a call center worker, answering, you know, sometimes rather disturbing questions about, you know, I can't breathe, you know, my husband is lying on the ground or whatever, like just, you know, things that they were not prepared for. And yeah, so it, in that sense, it was not like a classical privatization. And I think it's really important to distinguish that the way big tech moves in looks different also because of the financial power they've gained over the last decade. So their power is not necessarily in capturing that kind of very simple privatization, but capturing the whole infrastructure, which is just hard to imagine and quite different.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so much in there that to think about. So let's kind of try and break that down a little then, step by step. So can you say a bit more about the kind of computational infrastructure then that's kind of central to the story you're trying to tell? So, you know, what do we need to understand that and how has the kind of COVID response been built on that infrastructure that you're talking about?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean something very, very specific with computational infrastructure. And, you know, in the fields that I touch as a computer scientist, like information science and studies, people have been talking a lot about data infrastructures, right? Building on the work of Jeff Bowker and Susan Lee Starr. But I really mean like the material infrastructure. And specifically, I'm referring to the clouds. So for many people who know a little bit about technology, and they've used either something like iCloud or they've used some Amazon-based services, or they've used Microsoft Office, which is now, you know, Office 365 or Google Docs, right? Like those are, so to say, all programs that are running on the cloud, right? And the biggest cloud providers are Amazon, much greater than any other company by far, followed by Microsoft, which used to be a software company, but practically in the 2010s, they pivoted to become a cloud company. And the reason we kind of got here is maybe also relevant. So if you were around in the 90s, right, we were, the business of computing was still organized very much around personal computers or computer or on-premise servers. And so software was something you bought in a box, right? Like you, instead of queuing up to get iPhones, people would queue up to get Windows operating system, right? Like, and you'd get a box, and the box, depending on how old you are, either had diskettes or CDs or DVDs, and then you'd install, and sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. And with the 90s, with the rise of the internet, competing companies to Microsoft really use this advantage to deliver software through the net, right? And instead of, you know, the massive distribution and of boxes, right, which also affects the production of software, where you have to write the software and then you say, okay, today we're done. We're not going to do any more corrections. We're not going to do any more changes. We're going to slip those disks into a box and send it out. They could now deliver software over a browser, right? You could click a button and the software would load and it would be on your computer. Now you were still maintaining the software. So that was not great because the maintenance is difficult. You know, little by little, since the 90s, what we've been seeing is, you know, things that are called like web services or service-oriented architectures, where software is no longer brought to you discreetly, but you just, you know, kind of use the software that is on somebody else's server, like Google Docs versus, you know, having Microsoft Word on your on your computer. And this is a huge difference, right? Like, aside from the fact that your files are now on somebody else's server, you might not be able to find them if you're not online. It also means that every action you take with the software is trackable. And that tracking has allowed software providers, which are now service providers, to track user response and to continuously optimize the design so that they can get the response they would like from these users, right? And this is not, you know, like Shoshana Zubov's kind of manipulation that we're talking about. But it's really like making an operation of delivering software and services that are optimized to the bottom line of the company, using the clicks as a sort of feedback into the operations of that company. So clouds basically became the way services get delivered, partially because if you deliver software through services and you have to have software running on your server, you now have a cost, right? And that cost kind of got turned into a business model, which became the cloud, where somebody else provides you the service. And as a company, you can just use somebody else's servers to start providing services to millions and maybe billions of people, right? I'm telling you all these details because they become eventually important for what kind of imaginary cloud has of society. So for cloud, so you can think about Amazon, Microsoft, Google is trying really hard to catch up. So those are the three companies I'm thinking of. And of course, there are other smaller cloud companies that are also relevant. But in terms of like the financial boost that these companies got, those are the three that I'm looking at. And then with mobile devices, which we see as accessories of the cloud. And I say that because we've moved away from the personal computer that you manage yourself, you maintain yourself, to holding devices that are basically maintained by the companies. This is why Apple could do a silent update on your phone and push contact tracing onto it, right? So in the sense, it's not a personal device, it's a managed device, it's an accessory on the cloud where most of its functionality is on the cloud. And you basically use your phone, and if you go through a tunnel and your internet is gone, none of your apps work because all of them are running on the cloud somewhere. So for me, computational infrastructure is the cloud plus these mobile devices as their accessories. And they have become, in a sense, the default place for software production. What I mean by that is, just like governments could not have apps without going through Google and Apple, it's practically, economically, if you're in a competitive business, not possible not to go through the cloud plus mobile model to deliver software to people today. So they've captured, so to say, software production globally.
And that, and what does that mean in terms of kind of power relationships? I mean, how do, what does this mean in terms of, you know, kind of the social and political consequences for those of us who are walking around with these devices in our pockets and are kind of plugged into this infrastructure?
I would love to know the answer to that question, but I think that's like the, that is the question, right? Like, but we can try to touch it, right? Like, first of all, what you have is what we could consider a massive infrastructural power, right? In the sense that if you are an organization that wants to have, you know, contact or have access to people, either as a government or as a company that wants to do advertisement or a news agency, what have you, right? The most powerful and potentially default infrastructure is to go through this cloud and mobile space that I just mapped out, which is in mm-hmm. the hands of a few companies, right? And so I think that's already massive power, right? And to think about the fact that the infrastructure is, of course, organized in a certain way and it's optimized in a certain way and it is subject to financial pressure means that that infrastructure power in and of itself becomes something we must understand and keep an eye on because it's usually invisible, right? Like you know, we consider data or algorithms or we consider the media, right?
Right,
But to consider that the way an infrastructure is built, in this case, this computational infrastructure, determines what it means to access who and what are the conditions under which that access is possible is determined by four or five companies, but they are even also by now determined by their infrastructure, right? Like the design is, so to say, sedimented. Uh-huh. And so I think that's really important. Now, the other element is what we call pocket power, which is that even if these companies cannot get organizations or governments to accept certain services, they can enter them through our pockets, right? Right. And we saw this, you know, at my university, our IT people were smart enough to say, look, Zoom, which we're also using, by the way, and at that time it was a slightly different design, although that doesn't make them much better now. They were, for privacy and security reasons, really a very not appropriate software to be used in an educational setting. So our ICT department said we shouldn't use it. But then, you know, professors came and said, but I use Zoom. So could you guys get us some licenses anyways, right?
Right, right.
And if you think about it from the perspective of the business of computing, enterprise software, which Microsoft has mastered and to some extent IBM, is not trivial. It is, in a sense, I think much more easier if you have a service that is already accepted and used by millions and billions of people. And then those people bring that service and make it normal in the organization. So that's happened with Gmail, that's happened mm-hmm. with Google Drive, that's happened with, you know, mm-hmm. colleagues communicating over WhatsApp, or as I said, mm-hmm. professors asking for Zoom. And I think we should not underestimate this pocket power, which is basically using what the industry has focused on for decades, which is the user is king, right? Like you must have a great experience and all other stakeholders don't matter, right? Like they've really managed to push this through things like agile software development methodologies as a way to enter organizations that otherwise they would have to go through a tender process and a contract process and et cetera. So there are different ways in which this power shows itself. And I think it's really an interesting question to study how that works out.
And so can you say a bit more about how this looks then in terms of that relationship between governments and these corporations like Amazon and Apple and Google and so forth. So, so if I've understood you rightly, you're sort of saying that the kind of infrastructural power that these corporations are at the helm of has given them a kind of seat at the table, if nothing more, at least that mm-hmm. In things that seem at first sight to be, you know, unrelated to their core business, like public health, right? Mm-hmm. They've got that seat at the table. So, can you say a bit more about how that relationship then looks between those corporations and governments around things like public health? I mean, you said that we can't understand it in a kind of conventional sense of privatization, but can you try and paint a picture for us of how you would describe that a little more?
I mean, again, I think it's not a simple story, right? And you know, for I think a lot of my colleagues, again, I don't know if this is, you know, seen that way in other fields or other activists or political circles, but it's kind of seen as, you know, there's this corporate power coming through big tech and the governments are, you know, separate right, and try to regulate them or, right, you know, are maybe a counter power, et cetera. Uh-huh. But I think what we saw with COVID, and again, like, you know, we did some measurement studies to show that what we could call like the cloudification of public institutions, and we specifically looked at educational institution, has been ongoing, right? Like, this is not just a COVID project, although COVID, I think, maybe made it faster. Although, like, if you look at the bottom lines of these companies, it definitely made it faster. But it also maybe exposed some of the power of these companies, mm-hmm. right? Like, that they're kind of taking over institutions, like, mm-hmm. massively, you know, fast scale. And so I think there are a couple of things that we need to think about. One is, I think governments are understanding this power and kind of excited about it, right? When we were building the contact tracing apps, for example, I got calls, I think, a couple of times where government entities would ask, could you limit the number of notifications people get? Could we mess with that, right? Because, you know, we had a very concrete definition. If you're a contact, you get a notification.
Right.
But they said, you know, if we don't have enough beds, maybe we don't notify people because we don't want them to go to the hospital. But right, I mean, if we look at the fact that, you know, some of these governments that we're calling have invested no money into public health since COVID, right, and sometimes they have even cut down the number of beds, you can see how the possibility to optimize number of beds versus notifications as a form of public health is just very yummy for them and very scary for us, right. And so I think you saw, in a sense, governments being excited about using this infrastructure for their own interests, and we saw, I think, these big tech companies saying, "Let's work together," right?
And so the government excitement derives from that kind of ability to very precisely kind of manage populations and reactions and behavior through this infrastructure. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a form of population management, right? Like, I think, I have to give a hat tip to my collaborator, Martha Poon, with whom I discuss a lot of these things, and she's not here now. So almost, you know, most of the things I say can be attributed to her. But I think that what these infrastructures do is they enable a certain kind of operational control. Those are the terms that Martha uses. And if they do well in that, which means that it reduces cost and it has some sort of, like, it fulfills some requirement for effectivity, then they can capture an existing infrastructure, right? Like, so in that sense, you can see Facebook, although they don't really have as much of power as the other four companies I talked about, right? Like Amazon and Microsoft with Google, with cloud, and Google and Apple with their mobile devices. You know, Facebook doesn't own mobile devices, right? Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't have that kind of power, and it's not really a cloud go-to. But they have been the go-to for advertisement and for accessing people, right? And if you look there, what they're doing continuously is to super refine their operation for advertisement to become the default place for all advertisement. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So you're capturing what was maybe not even seen as an infrastructure that went through, you know, ad companies, advertisement companies, and maybe the press, right? Like, different publishing houses, et cetera, that would, or the TV broadcast, or different institutions, which would be the infrastructure through which ads normally would be delivered, to now all of those parties go through Facebook, and have to not only give a cut of their income to Facebook, but are completely dependent on them to act in this field as publishers or broadcasters or news agencies, et cetera. So I think if we for a moment pause and say, this whole thing is not massively about profiling individuals, and that's where its power comes from, but it's about refining an infrastructure and making it the default, and shifting whole industries or sectors onto it for that operational need, right? Like, for delivering ads in the case of Facebook and Google, for delivering goods in the case of Amazon, the e-commerce website, but delivering all software in the case of cloud and the mobile devices as its accessories, you start to understand the shape of this thing and ways to kind of try to understand that it's not about individuals as much anymore as creating an operation through which populations can be managed, right? And the emphasis is on that operational capture, where maybe we can say the capture of the people is somewhat done, right? It can be refined, but it's kind of done.
Right. And so I mean, you mentioned the UK and France. So can you say a bit more about like how this might look in different parts of the world, or like the story you're telling? Is that something that's a European story, or how does it look elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that's also another like super interesting research question, right? And in collaboration with the Institute for Technology in the Public Interest, which includes myself, but also Miriam Arak and Helen Pritchard and Femke Snelting, we're also asking some of these questions of how are things different in different situations. And we're currently in the process of asking, okay, what happens if these government entities are not there or have been failing or struggling? And specifically, we've been asking the question, what happens in, for example, in Lebanon, right? Like after the multiple crises that they have been going through over the last couple of years. Or, you know, in another project, we're looking to see, okay, could we bring contact tracing apps to a couple of countries in sub-Saharan Africa? And there we're also seeing that not only is the position of these tech companies different, but also the position of the government and civil society and knowledge about these companies is very, very different. And so we ask, okay, what does it mean to capture operation when the state is kind of failing, right? Then you really become the default, but how much do these companies need these governments to uphold a certain position so that they can capture operations? I think in the case of Kenya, and what you see is that a lot of tech companies have just chosen Kenya as an experiment ground, which means that they can do really unethical and politically concerning stuff and get away with it in a way that they wouldn't in Europe. And then the question mark is, would they get away with it in the US? So I think, yes, those things are very different. And then the other thing that's, of course, very different is that the cloud companies that I just accounted for do not account for all the companies that are very powerful. We have a bunch of them also in China. Mm-hmm. And I think, for example, with the war, I've seen some writing by computer scientists from Russia. I don't know what school they are, but saying, you know, Russia has already been looking at ways to exit this infrastructure in the hands of these four companies. And here's a plan, and we're going to collaborate with China to do that, right? Like, so right. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how these regional manifestations differ. Although, of course, these companies like to project themselves as universal, global, somewhat comparable wherever they go. So that's why they can say, we'll do contact tracing across the globe, right?
Right. And so can you say a bit about, I know it's difficult to think about the future, but how does this look going forward? You've talked about how these tech companies are, they're not necessarily thinking about immediate profitability on some of these actions. They're building up a kind of positioning, right? Relationships with governments, capturing a certain space. But where do they go with that over the coming years? And specifically around public health, I mean, what does this look like in terms of how we might see public health evolving, say, for example, in Europe? And, Europe's an interesting place for this question, right? Because it's...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, because probably more so than anywhere in the world, it has a certain... I mean, it's not always upheld, obviously, but it has a certain sense of like norms of public health and what that means in terms of a democracy and so forth, right? That people have fought for and established over the course, especially of the 20th century, National Health Service in Britain and so forth, right? Certainly more so than the United States and most other places in the world, right? Is there a way that these developments that you're describing impact on that?
Yeah, I think so. So there are multiple things that could be said. I mean, first of all, I think the cloud has an imagination of organizations. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that an organization is no longer an institution that gets IT support, but an organization sits on top of the cloud and bundles a bunch of services and stretches it out to their constituents, right? Yeah, yeah. And in a sense, I mean, this is so normalized. We taught a class and we asked students to study six companies, and they chose them depending on what they were interested in. And it was just fantastic to see, you know, Uber basically exists on the cloud, right? Or a company like Netflix Plastic, you know, practically exists on top of Amazon, even though Amazon has Prime, right? Like, right, so right, right. Like, it is so like, it, yeah, it's amazing. But I think what they would like is to have, you know, universities be little shells that exist on the cloud, right? Like, right. It's just a bunch of digital services, like whatever, right. MS Teams plus Zoom plus, you know, whatever right. HR service for hiring, et cetera. And then so right. you can basically gut out much of the administration and much of the operational makeup of organizations and move it to the cloud and use the organization just to keep on stretching the cloud to, right. Right. In the case of the university, to students, right? Like in the case of the health system, to patients and public health system to the people that public health is supposed to serve, although they don't always. So I think the imagination is really just to keep on doing that, to basically, you know, if we think about Facebook and Google as having made their billions, if not trillions, by capturing everybody's advertisement budget, this thing is up for capturing everybody's IT budget, but IT is supposed to be everything that an organization right. does, right. except right. that little shell that says, we're the university, here's our flag, here's our, right. you right. know, he's our president, and here are the professors who are also, of course, like using services to, yeah. yeah. right? Like, yeah. so I think that's the imagination, at least organization-wise. And I think there's also other imaginations that I don't necessarily study, but which is about managing disenfranchised populations. So basically, instead of making money off of individual users, you basically get a government to pay you and you manage, let's say, a refugee camp, right? Like, because you have the phones, you have the whole infrastructure, or you give them cards or whatever, you give them some dongles, and then you can manage anywhere from, I mean, everything that's logistical that can be digitized, they can manage, right? Right. And then all the expensive and complicated stuff will be pushed on to governments or whoever else to take care of. Right. And if nobody's taking care of it, that means we will have to take care of it. So I think it's kind of interesting to see how they capture, and indeed, it's not just like straightforward privatization, but a complete reimagination of the organization as a structure. Yeah, I think maybe that's a good starting point. And then what we did see when COVID started, and I don't know how that will play out, is, you know, with the lockdowns, especially, I was kind of joking about how it split the society first into two. And then I was like, maybe it's three and maybe there's more parts, but it created a delivery class and a receiver class, right? Mm-hmm. And the delivery was those care workers who were delivering the care, so doctors and nurses and what have you, and those who were delivering packages. Right. Like, so all the people who brought the Amazon orders and whatever home, and then the receiver class were receiving orders either to keep business going as usual, but from home, or receiving their packages from these online services. And if you can imagine that, you know, in an ideal world, Amazon would not need the shops, right? Like Amazon right. just needs to deliver. Right. And so then I think that was also kind of a quick exposure into the kind of society that they imagine, with, of course, certain populations falling out of both of those. And they're like the policed, the managed population, mm-hmm. right? And that's where we get the refugee camps or people without shelter who are then absolutely surveilled and policed and using these technologies. So I think it's kind of interesting to think about how does the cloud imagine us, so that we can develop counter imaginaries, because I think these were like little windows into the imagination of society through these cloud companies mm-hmm. with mobile devices as their accessories. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, the story that you're telling, I mean, it seems like it's something that hasn't been focused on enough at all. Even just thinking about the COVID question. And you know, do you think the left and liberals have kind of failed to really see some of this stuff? Because you know, we've kind of had this desire almost for the state and for tech corporations to be the solution in this moment. You know, like we want them to save us, as it were, right? And so we've kind of not been as questioning, perhaps, as we might have been of some of the kind of political questions that are implied in what you've just been describing.
I think there are many ways why we landed here, right? I think it's you know, there was a lot of excitement about the internet. It was going to connect us all, right?
Like, right.
And it was going to like be this amazing thing. And, you know, there were always voices like Paula Chakravarti and Miriam Arak saying this is an imperial infrastructure. But, you know, we had then people at Berkman saying it's going to free us, right?
Like,
So, you know, who to blame? Like, we were all excited about the internet, right? But I think what happened, and this is, again, like Marta's wisdom, is that the business of computing, which was, you know, which kind of crashed into the internet and then kind of crashed into the global financial system that was looking for good investment object after 2008, right? And you know, there's a lot of relationship between finance and computing from the beginning. I think they built something on top of the internet that has become invisible to us. And I think that, you know, if I look at some of the critical work in the fields, again, that I touch on or that has now also bled into computer science, a lot of the consideration has been about data and data collection and surveillance, right? And not about capture, infrastructure build, what it means for political economy. And so that didn't work. Instead, that was not done. And instead, we were, you know, very worried about privacy, including myself. I worked on privacy for many years. And then most recently about algorithms and automation and what it would do to labor or algorithmic discrimination. And all of those framings, which I have to admit were not only coming out of critical scholars, but also very much supported by industry, right? And these research centers that were continuously budding, that was, you know, originally getting half a million or a million or two from Microsoft or Google or whatever, were really pushed and became the main framework through which to look at technology. So technology was going to be innovating and it had edges and those edges could be captured with data and algorithms. And we could either tweak the algorithms or, you know, shave off some of the data and then it would all be fine without looking at the fact that these were massive infrastructures with their own imagination of what the future of society is and with an infrastructure that is, you know, so strong that it even drives the engineers, right? Like you can't as an engineer just go and change this infrastructure. It's already established in many ways, right? It's just like saying we'll take cars off the roads, right? Like what are you gonna do with the roads, right? Like I mean I'm sure people have imagination of what to do, but what I'm trying to say is that the infrastructure has been built for decades and decades and it's so settled and so invisible to us. So I think not seeing it has been to our detriment, and I really hope that more people ask questions about it and kind of look into things beyond, you know, how people are having agency vis-a-vis an algorithm to, right? Like, what does it mean if the university is just a little shell sitting on top of the cloud, or any public administration or public health, et cetera.
And so what are, you know, are there ways that we can imagine making demands of, say, local government, municipalities, or public health departments to you know, adopt policies that might at least, you know, contain some of this or limit some of this. Is that something that we can imagine?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, to connect the previous question to the one now, a lot of governments have gone for a cloud first strategy, meaning like they're literally pushing cloud in their countries because they have been told by consultants that this is the way to go with technical innovation. And COVID has really, you know, activated governments across Europe and probably to some extent in the US, although, you know, as you said, public health looks different in the US, to digitize the public sector. Like they've really just been caught by the consultants that are like pushing cloud all the time. And so I think it's going to be a big battle, right? Like it's going to be a very difficult thing to push back against because, you know, we have multi-trillion-dollar industry saying get on the cloud under terms like digital transformation. It's another podcast probably, but, you know, machine learning is for me absolutely a driver to the cloud. It's not we didn't like make massive breakthroughs in computer science. No, we just managed to make compute very, we found a way to do compute in a very compute heavy way, which is machine learning. And the best place to do it is the cloud. Like, surprise. And so I think the push is going to be very hard, but the push is there, but it hasn't really quite happened yet, right? And so I think there are at least two levels I can think about that are really going to be important. One is to be very keen on hearing about digital transformation in our organizations, and this could be public institutions or any organization actually, to say, you know, what is the vision of this institution or organization that this cloud or digital transformation going to serve? Because right now we're doing digital transformation for digital transformation because it's going to innovate the organization, mm-hmm. which actually means that that organization is open to change.
Right.
And the question is, can we turn it around and say, okay, if you're open to change, let's talk about what that change is and make sure that the digital transformation serves that instead of the organization serving the clouds, right? Like, so I think that's like a very important direction to go. And then with respect to everyday practices, I think it's also really important to talk with, you know, and this is a really difficult one since public health institutions across Europe also have been really struggling with austerity that they've been subject to over the last few decades, to say, what is your practice and how are you going to maintain it? Or what does it mean to change it so that you serve people better? And how do you then ask for technology that allows you to do that? Mm-hmm. I can give you the example of immunity passports. I think mm-hmm. They're basically these certificates that you get if you've gotten multiple vaccines or if you've gotten a test or if you've recovered from COVID, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, they of course went also into the phones, right? Like,
right.
And so when I talk with people in public health, Martha and I explained it to them as follows. We said, your job in public health is to inform and enable people to make good health decisions. When your practice gets translated into the phone to certificates, it becomes a practice of checks. Have mm-hmm. you done this, right? Mm-hmm. Right? That is a complete transformation of your practice. So let's talk about, is this what you want your practice to be? Right. Or is it something else? And what does it mean for, you know, somebody standing in an airport, somebody standing at the door of a restaurant to be checking these things with no public health knowledge? So what does it mean to have your workforce replaced by a bunch of people holding phones and doing checks, right? Mm-hmm. And so to be very diligent in the changes that happen to practice, because as I said, this infrastructure has a very specific understanding of how we interact, or, right? Like, of course you can expand it and you can design systems differently, et cetera. But, you know, it has its kind of paths that it has already selected. Mm-hmm. And to say, if it doesn't serve you, why are you going on the cloud? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, these are very simple questions that don't get asked, for example, if you just look at data and algorithms, and if you just look at, right, algorithmic discrimination or what have you, which are all actually frames pushed by industry to avoid regulation and to make it seem like by tweaking algorithms, they can solve all problems.
Thank you, Seda. That was really helpful. There's so much stuff there to think about, and you explained it really clearly. So thank you very much.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundanani and Dr. Seda Gueses, who is an associate professor at TU Delft and an affiliate at KU Leuven. This episode is part of a monthly series on the securitization of health, hosted by Arun Kundanani. Be sure to also check out previous episodes and look out for upcoming ones. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.